Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Things aren't always as they appear, and some bombshells might be hiding in plain sight. I'm Katie Bilotti, and this is Found Objects, a storytelling history podcast. Welcome in, everyone. Welcome back to Found Objects History Podcast with me, Katie Bilotti. Today, I'm bringing to you guys a story that has been highly suggested, and I've actually gotten a few DMs about this from you guys. As a note, if you ever have a story that you want me to cover and you want Sarah, my lovely researcher, to look into and fact check, please just send me a DM and I will check it out and perhaps it will become an episode on this podcast. This one was suggested a couple of times and it is the very juicy yet very sad story of Marilyn Monroe, her rise to fame, and her interactions with JFK, President John F. Kennedy, and the Kennedy family, Bobby Kennedy, just kind of that interesting web of truth and lies and drama that unfolded during the 1960s, but also Marilyn's life and how she came to fame, because her story is very interesting as well. And like I said, it's very sad. There are some triggering aspects to this story, abuse and various things. So it is a sensitive episode, just letting you guys know. But it is an important story worth telling because I think that this story, because there's so many conspiracy theories surrounding Marilyn's death and a bunch of things, you know, it's hard to figure out what is true, what's false. And we did our very, very best. Sarah worked her booty off to fact check this story. So what I'm going to tell you guys today is the true story of Marilyn and John F. Kennedy, as far as we know. And buckle up, everyone. Hope you guys are also doing well today. Just, I feel like I forgot to say that, but I hope you guys are doing well and are ready for this tumultuous tale. Okay, let's get into it. I want us to go back in time to the first time we ever saw a wedding unfold. And that could be on TV. You know, I don't really even remember my first wedding. I think I was definitely under the age of 4. So I don't have a memory that I personally witnessed, but I saw a number of different TV shows, movies where it was depicted. And it was, you know, this beautiful wedding day. Usually a church was involved in these early pictures that I saw. And, you know, the bride and groom were running out of the church. Their family members are throwing rice on them. It was usually a woman wearing a long white satin gown, the man in a tux. They're running into a car with those like tin cans, you know, on little ribbons tied to it. And it says just married. They're taking like the next leap into whatever comes after that, right? Like a lot of these things we don't often see, or we do because it's a dramatic rom-com of sorts of what happens next. And, you know, we oftentimes see this beautiful picture, but especially when we're young and we're witnessing this for the first time, or pouring through photo albums of family members with very similar pictures to this, like in front of the church and rice and all of that, we don't necessarily see the negative aspects, you know, the people having cold feet before they get married, the people that call off their wedding only to maybe still have the wedding but have these fears. We don't really see that pictured a lot of times in like the fairy tale look at it, right? So we don't see the fact that, you know, statistically speaking, according to the American Psychological Foundation, 40 to 50% of marriages end in divorce. That's nearly half of marriages. You know, that figure itself can either cloud someone's judgment or it can propel them to beat the odds. They're like, that won't happen to me. That's not me and my person, you know? And there's all sorts of things that lead to divorce. There's financial struggles. There's just, you know, you fall out of love, or, you know, there's issues with conceiving, with raising a family. But for many, the issue can be infidelity, cheating. Cheating is a tale as old as time. If we're talking history, you know, there have been cheaters since the very beginning of time. And it runs the gamut of one person falling in love with a coworker, or one person seeking something new and fresh, you know, getting tired of their day-to-day with just one person, they want something new, so they stray from the marriage. Like, you name it, the reason exists. There's so many very unique cases out there when someone cheats for any number of reasons. And they have a very unique way also of justifying their actions. Cheaters do. And this is an issue that doesn't discriminate, right? Like, it doesn't matter who you are. It doesn't matter how rich you are. It doesn't matter how in love you once were. It doesn't matter if you have a family. It infiltrates many, many households, including the most famous household in the United States, the White House. Ah, yes, infidelity amongst presidents. There are very many scandalous stories throughout history about this particular genre of cheating. Lyndon B. Johnson was said to have had an affair with a White House staffer. Gerald R. Ford was said to have had an affair with a German spy. George H.W. Bush was said to have had an affair with his aide. And Bill Clinton, well, we all know the stories of Bill Clinton. But the most infamous presidential cheater of all time was John Jack F. Kennedy. Obviously, there's a lot to unpack when the Kennedys are concerned. And the Kennedys, the story of the Kennedys is just so interesting. There's been so many, you know, documentaries and books written on it, the Kennedy curse, so much to unpack. But we're going to focus today on JFK. And as we know from the Jackie and Lee episode slash just knowing this, I feel like many people know this just kind of as fact that JFK was one to get around. Dozens of women after his assassination came out to say that they had an affair with JFK at one point or another, from college students to White House staffers. And as we know, his wife Jackie was not naive to what was happening under her nose. A 2012 story in The Atlantic said that JFK had relations with secretaries named Priscilla Ware and Jill Cowan, with whom he would go skinny dipping in the White House swimming pool. It's been widely reported that while First Lady Jackie was giving a French reporter a tour of the presidential home, she passed by one of the secretary's desks and said in French, quote, "This is the girl who supposedly is sleeping with my husband." Perhaps the most famous of all of his escapades, though, was his rumored affair with Marilyn Monroe. And yes, that will be the subject of today's story. Marilyn Monroe, let's talk about her and her upbringing, her background. She was so much more than the golden girl of Hollywood that many of us know her as. Born in 1926 as Norma Jean Mortensen, she was greeted with a broken home from the get-go. Young Marilyn could never have guessed how her life would pan out. Growing up, she spent time in 10 foster homes. In fact, her mother, Gladys Baker, dropped her off at the foster home of Ida and Wayne Bolander in Hawthorne, California, when she was only 2 weeks old. And there's still little known about her father to this day. Yes, 2 weeks old. I didn't know this part, that I remember hearing that she had had a rough childhood, but I didn't know that she had bounced around between 10 foster homes, guys. Like, that would shape a person, especially being abandoned at 2 weeks old. Like, that sends chills up my spine. Her time in foster care was actually not all bad, though. Marilyn's early years was spent with, like I said, she was dropped off at Ida and Wayne Bolander's house by her mom at 2 weeks old. And Ida was very religious, and she ran the household with a firm but compassionate grasp. And Marilyn grew closer to her foster brothers and sisters. This stable upbringing was ripped away from her, though, when Ida decided that Marilyn, at 7 years old, should live with her mother again. And for a while, Gladys Baker, Marilyn's biological mother, rose to the occasion. She procured a loan for a new house near the Hollywood Bowl and took in actors George and Maude Atkinson as boarders to provide financial support and companionship. However, a series of unfortunate events prompted things to take a turn for the worse in the fall of 1933. Marilyn's mom finally caved to her personal demons and pressures in mid-1934, with Marilyn witnessing her mother kicking and screaming wildly before the police were called. Diagnosed as a, quote, paranoid schizophrenic, she was institutionalized for the first time at the state hospital in Norwalk. Following her mom's institutionalization, Marilyn lived in an orphanage for 2 years before being sent to another foster home. From there, she lived with her new legal guardian, Grace Goddard, or her mom's sister-in-law, on and off. Her world was in shambles until she finally regained some stability when she landed in the home of Aunt Anna, Goddard's family friend. Her mother was in and out of her life as she went in and out of mental institutions, and Marilyn once said, quote, "I was not an orphan. I was brought up a waif. I was never used to being happy, so that was not something I was counting on." But of course, everyone wants happiness. You know, everyone, I would say, most people want happiness. They want love in any capacity. And Marilyn married James Dougherty. The marriage between James and Marilyn, or Norma Jean at this time, was somewhat unusual in that it was really born out of convenience for her. You see, the Goddard family wanted to move out of LA, but they didn't want to leave Norma Jean, who would ultimately end up back in the foster system, so they proposed the idea of getting married to James Dougherty. While it was a strange arrangement, they hit it off, and she was only 16 at the time, which is really upsetting. But they married in 1942, and it was a beautiful, loving marriage at first. James joined the U.S. Merchant Marines, and she took the role as housewife. They lived in Sherman Oaks until Dougherty's job took him to Catalina Island. They were in a stage of honeymoon bliss. How could you not when you lived on the beaches of Catalina? But things took a turn for Marilyn in 1944. James left California for his first overseas assignment, and in the meantime, Marilyn did her part to help with the war effort by joining the Radioplane Company. What she didn't know is, while at the factory, photographer David Conover, who was on assignment documenting women in the war effort, would notice her. He called her, quote, "a real morale booster," and became infatuated with taking her pictures. She became his model for the assignment. After modeling for Conover, Norma Jean signed with the Blue Book Modeling Agency and made her passion for acting clear as well. And this is the time when Norma Jean, the name Norma Jean, or whoever she was before, faded away and Marilyn stepped up to the plate. And the story surrounding her name change from Norma Jean to Marilyn Monroe, like how did she go from Norma Jean to Marilyn? So apparently a studio executive was talking with her and was like, there's too many ways to say your last name, Dougherty. There's just too many ways. People are going to say it wrong. It just doesn't sound right. And they somehow came up with the name Marilyn and then decided, or she decided herself, that she would tack on Monroe to the end because it was her mom's maiden name. And so Marilyn Monroe was then born. And shortly after that, Marilyn filed for divorce from James. Their marriage officially ended in September of 1946, and he claimed that studio executives pressured Marilyn to end their marriage because they didn't want a, quote, pregnant starlet. But she claimed later in life that she was genuinely unhappy in the marriage. So it could have been kind of like a cop-out from him to say that, or just something to say, to be like, she didn't want to end the marriage, you know. She was married to me at 16 and all, but like, it's just so messed up that she was married at 16. Anyway, in an interview, Marilyn said, quote, "My marriage didn't make me sad, but it didn't make me happy either. My husband and I hardly spoke to each other, and this wasn't because we were angry. We just had nothing to say. I was dying of boredom." In 1946, Marilyn was now 20 years old, and her career had skyrocketed before her very eyes. Marilyn knew she could model, but her real passion was acting. She'd been obsessed with movies from a young age and knew little about acting, but she wanted to learn. She had a short-lived contract with 20th Century Fox, but they dropped her in 1947. I mean, I'm just thinking to myself, or just thinking in general, like, whoever dropped her from 20th Century Fox in 1947 was definitely kicking themselves later on when she became this huge star. Like, people were probably like, what were you thinking? Like, whoever that guy was then probably known as the guy that, like, let Marilyn Monroe walk. Anyway, unfortunately, getting noticed in Hollywood at that time meant playing the industry game. To get her name out there, Marilyn had to associate herself with all the right people and be seen at all the right destinations. There were rumors of a black book in the film industry back then that listed all of the aspiring actresses willing to get laid for a role, and her name was supposedly on that list. She knew the men were sleazy, but she used this to her advantage. Supposedly, she wanted to be taken seriously and given real roles, so she did what she had to do. She befriended Joseph Schenck, who convinced Columbia Pictures to sign her in 1948. They gave her a 6-month contract, but decided ultimately not to renew either. Another person who was definitely kicking themselves later on. In 1948, she was then thrown back out, wooing whoever she needed to woo to get somewhere. Whatever she did worked because she caught the eye of Johnny Hyde, one of the most influential agents in the country. He simply adored Marilyn. He was smitten with her, and he even left his wife for a woman 30 years his junior. Marilyn was 23 at the time, and he was 53. But boy, did she reap the benefits of this relationship with Hyde. You know, she really wanted to get somewhere with her acting, and this is honestly a tale as old as time, unfortunately, like what you have to do to get noticed. You know, he had all the right connections in Hollywood, and he worked them for her. Plus, when they met, he was very sick and supposedly only had 18 months to live. So he, you know, was only around for a short time anyway, so Marilyn kind of kept that into consideration, like, oh, he's not going to be around very much longer anyway, but he devoted every last minute of his life to Marilyn. Most importantly, he helped her get her role in The Asphalt Jungle. And though her role in that film was very short, her performance was raved about and got her on the radars of people in Hollywood. And this is what moved her effectively from movie model to serious actress. In December of 1950, her husband negotiated a 7-year contract for her with 20th Century Fox. So she's back to Fox. For Marilyn, it was only an upward trajectory from there. She was unique and undeniably talented. Marilyn quickly became the most famous woman in the world. And I mean, she still is. Like, everyone knows Marilyn Monroe. It's a household name, and everyone knows her story. Maybe not every intricate detail of her story. Like, before researching her, I did not know that she, you know, had gone to 10 different foster homes. Like, that is definitely a part of the story that not many people know. But, you know, she has created such a name for herself, or, you know, and even other people are reaping the benefits of her name even to this day, like Kim Kardashian in her dress at the Met Gala. In Marilyn's own words, she said, quote, "I want to do the best I can in that moment. In that moment, I want to be perfect." But of course, we know how the story ends. Of course, you know, to know Marilyn Monroe is also to know the tragic ending to her story. Her desire to be America's favorite actress, a model of perfection, led to her death in 1962, only 10 years into her truly blossoming career. So what happened to Hollywood's shining star, Marilyn Monroe, formerly Norma Jean? What happened in those 10 years in Hollywood that ultimately destroyed her? The tale of her untimely death has been shrouded in mystery for decades. Was it suicide, accidental overdose, or something more sinister? The breakthrough happened in an investigation of Dr. Ralph Greenson, the Hollywood psychiatrist who treated her in the years before her death. His papers divulged that she had mental health issues. She had a tendency towards paranoia, but she was not schizophrenic like her mother. In his notes from their sessions, he noted that her time as an almost orphan was hard for her to forget. It, you know, the trauma, it left a lasting imprint on her adulthood for obvious reasons. She was passed around the foster system like a football for 6 years until she married James Doherty when she was 16, and Dr. Ralph Greenson, the Hollywood psychiatrist, recognized that, you know, in analyzing Marilyn and her behavior, that what she needed was a solid family. So he did something very unconventional. He basically adopted her into his family. And this may seem, you know, to cross the line for a patient-doctor relationship, but he felt that he had to turn to non-traditional treatment methods because she was just too famous for hospitals or normal institutions. During her time under his care, she was known for dating super famous men. In Dr. Greenson's opinion, this was another way she tried to fill the void, fill the hole in her life for companionship. And this series of toxic relationships would be, ultimately, her undoing. With Dr. Greenson, Marilyn spoke of relationships with actors, the Hollywood elite, and, quote, the general. She was often discreet when discussing the general. And it's important to note that the general is actually how insiders at the U.S. Justice Department referred to Attorney General Robert Kennedy. More on that later. First, though, let's discuss another name you might be familiar with in regards to Marilyn, Joe DiMaggio, New York Yankees baseball player and one of Marilyn's most tumultuous relationships. They started dating in 1952 and then got married 2 years later in 1954. And while it was easygoing at first, Joe DiMaggio couldn't deal with being married to, quote, the nation's pinup. While they were together, Marilyn filmed one of her most successful films, The 7-Year Itch, which I really love. If you guys have a chance to watch it, definitely do. This movie featured the famous scene when Marilyn's white skirt flies up while standing over a subway grate in New York City. You've definitely seen it before, the scene that has been memorialized in posters, photos, statues, you name it. Following this in other films like Niagara and Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, which I also love, Marilyn became known as America's sex symbol. Of course, we know that there is much more to her, but this is what she was known as. According to insiders, Joe DiMaggio was super upset about the dress flying up scene and what it symbolized for the trajectory of her work. Her hairdresser at the time said that he was so distraught that he physically abused her for her willingness to show off her, quote, goods. Her hairdresser said that Marilyn came back to work with bruised shoulders. Red flag, red flag, red flag. Unsurprisingly, the marriage ended after only 9 months. In 1954, Marilyn moved back to LA from New York and understandably was in the throes of depression following her 9-month marriage. In an interview, she even said, quote, no one likes me. Everything I do turns to shit. While the latter is untrue, because we know from a box office perspective, you know, she was the it girl of 1952, the former had some truth to it. During this time, I mean, let's remember, she's recovering from this abusive relationship with Joe DiMaggio, but she was, of course, you know, back to work, and she became notoriously hard to work with. She was often late or didn't show up at all to rehearsals and filming, didn't remember her lines, and would demand several retakes before she was satisfied with her performances. Her dependence on her acting coaches also irritated directors. Like, she really needed assistance from people, which I guess was frustrating for the people that were hiring her. And, you know, now looking back, her problems have been attributed to many things. You know, of course, her trauma, but also, you know, she had combated severe perfectionism, which is really relatable to me because I find myself to be such a perfectionist, and it has really impacted my work over the years and my relationships. You know, she also suffered from low self-esteem and stage fright. To alleviate her anxiety and chronic insomnia, she turned to barbiturates, amphetamines, and alcohol, which of course did not help. After wrapping her contract with Fox in January of 1955 and being largely unhappy with how she was treated there, she returned to Manhattan and started her own production company, Marilyn Monroe Pictures, with photographer Milton Green. She was tired of all the same old, sexy roles and hoped to flip the script. Of course, she was mocked for her attempt to branch off on her own, but she started seriously studying acting. And this is when her life collided with that of Arthur Miller, one of the nation's most famous playwrights. And there's very famous photos of them together. You might have seen this guy. Like, I can see his face so clearly in my head right now. And their whirlwind romance began when she was 29 and he was 40. She craved artistic credibility and independence, and she wanted to grow with integrity and skill, and wanted to be taken seriously, not as this, quote, sex symbol. She wanted to be, you know, treated like everybody else, for crying out loud, like men were. And she knew that Arthur Miller could help her. By the end of 1955, she had re-signed a new 7-year contract with Fox. So back to Fox, but they were going to help her finance Marilyn Monroe production films. Fox would pay her $400,000 to make 4 films and granted her the right to choose her own projects and directors, which sounds like a great gig. And all was seeming in this time period to be looking up. You know, she'd re-upped with Fox and, you know, she was in love with this guy, Arthur Miller, that was taking her seriously. And this was getting serious, their relationship. They got married in a quiet ceremony in June of 1956, and he gave her a ring that was inscribed with, quote, "Now is forever." And she wrote on the back of the wedding photos, quote, "Hope, hope, hope." It seemed like she was trying to turn a new leaf. But then they went to London to film for Marilyn Monroe Productions, and she stumbled across some of Arthur's notes. She told her acting coach, quote, "He wrote something about how disappointed he was with me, how he thought I was some kind of angel, but he guessed he was wrong. He had married a woman as flawed as his previous wife had been." Oh, goosebumps, guys. This is just, I can't imagine stumbling across something like this, like from someone that you love and that you think respects you. Oh, just devastating for so many reasons. You know, first, her relationship with Arthur Miller was not supported by Fox. He was actually being investigated by the FBI for allegations of communist activity. And this relationship led to the FBI opening a file on Marilyn for suspicious activity as well. Second of all, she wanted a family. Like, that was all she wanted. Remember, like, she really wanted something that wasn't as chaotic as her own upbringing. And Dr. Greenson, that psychiatrist that, you know, adopted her into her family, emphasized that it's all she ever wanted in this world, and she thought that her chance at a family was with Arthur Miller. Sources say that if given a choice between children and stardom, Marilyn would have chosen children. So it was demoralizing, embarrassing, and heart-shattering to hear that her husband, who was supposed to love her unconditionally, thought of her in this way. But she powered through for that dream that she so desperately wanted. So she and Arthur returned to the U.S. from London in 1957 to focus on creating a family. Apparently, it's been said that she suffered from several miscarriages during this time. And then, in July of 1958, so after enduring all of that personal trauma, she returned to Hollywood just 1 year later to film Some Like It Hot, which honestly is one of my favorite films. Very, very good film. But during filming, she was pregnant again, but it also ended in a miscarriage. So these are all things I did not know. This led to depressive episodes similar to what she exhibited after her divorce from Joe DiMaggio. And this, of course, created, you know, a very tumultuous environment on set for Some Like It Hot. Marilyn demanded dozens of retakes, didn't remember her lines or act as directed, and her co-star famously, I mean, kind of terrible, but famously said that kissing her was like kissing Hitler due to the number of retakes. Marilyn privately likened the production to a sinking ship and commented on her co-stars and director Billy Wilder. Despite Marilyn and Wilder's differences, the movie was a critical and commercial success, and her performance even earned her a Golden Globe for Best Actress. In 1960, her mental health continued to deteriorate. While filming a film called Misfits, there was a rapid decline that she could just not hide anymore. She was reliant on narcotics yet again. And it's interesting because, you know, at the time, Marilyn was this it girl. People loved her. She was not, you know, someone that the public was unhappy with at any point, but Marilyn was unhappy with herself. You know, she was fearful that her trajectory was reminiscent of her mother's, who, let's remember, had mental health issues herself. And so she actually, Marilyn admitted herself to Payne Whitney Psychiatric Clinic in 1961. There, she sought treatment for her abuse of sleeping pills. Unfortunately, though, the press, of course, got wind of her stay and were waiting when she was released. She famously told them, quote, "I feel wonderful," over and over, but in truth, she was deeply emotionally distressed. She finally got divorced from Arthur Miller in January of 1961, on the very same day that JFK was inaugurated. Coincidence? Question mark? So, this is where we get into her relationship with Jack Kennedy, aka President of the United States and former senator, and Bobby Kennedy, U.S. Attorney General. Supposedly, Marilyn's relationship with the brothers started way before her divorce from Arthur Miller in 1961. Some say it started in the mid-1950s when Jack was still senator. Her relationship with Bobby started shortly thereafter. Yes, she was allegedly seeing both of them at the same time. Remember, she told Dr. Greenson of, quote, the general in the 1950s as well. To put it simply, Jack and Bobby really leaned into the smart, rich kid act. They were known to party at Malibu Inn and drink profusely at Malibu Cottage, a famously raunchy joint, and Marilyn was a fixture at most of their parties. Apparently, they would all meet up at Peter Lawford's house in Malibu as well, and he threw lots of famous parties, and the Kennedy brothers came because Peter was married to their sister. It was not uncommon for the brothers to hook up with women in the rooms next door. Kind of gives frat boy behavior energy to me. They took after their father, Joe Kennedy, who was not the most stand-up guy in that regard. He told them to, quote, get laid as often as you can with as many women as you want. So, how do we know all of this was going on? this is where things get interesting. James Hoffa, leader of the Teamsters Union and part of the Mafia, was not a fan of Bobby Kennedy. They often butted heads professionally for obvious reasons. One is in the Mafia and one is in the U.S. government. There was, of course, some animosity brewing there because of this fact. So James Hoffa hired a private detective named John Danoff to collect dirt on Bobby and Jack, which included their relationships with Marilyn Monroe. He bugged Peter Lawford's house in Malibu and Marilyn Monroe's home in Brentwood. It's important to note that while this is a huge invasion of privacy for anyone, it was especially a big deal for Marilyn. Her home was her safe space and a representation of a life she could lead on her own, you know, after all the husbands and whatnot. Her psychiatrist, Dr. Greenson, encouraged her to prove to herself that she could stand on her own two feet and create her own dream life. So she bought her own house for the first time in her life. And to our knowledge, she never knew her house was bugged, but knowing what her house meant to her, you know, made it all the more worse. According to the detective, there were 4 bugs planted in Marilyn's house. It caught Jack and Marilyn on tape planning a secret rendezvous, but they caught more interactions with Bobby than Jack at her house. He was there more often. Tapes at Peter's house caught Marilyn and Jack in the act, literally, so there was no question then of the affair. Now remember, Marilyn's association with Arthur Miller, the suspected communist in the midst of the Cold War, made her a target of observation by the FBI. Hence, they caught on to the affairs as well. In the FBI's eyes, Marilyn was absolutely the wrong woman to be on intimate terms with the president and the attorney general of the U.S. You know, there was nothing to prove that she was involved with the communists, but, you know, better safe than sorry, they thought. You know, she was a huge risk to national security because of these affairs. But of course, the FBI's warnings didn't stop Marilyn or the Kennedys from interacting. In 1962, Marilyn so publicly and so famously sang happy birthday for the president as part of his celebrations in New York City at Madison Square Garden. It was such a sensual performance. She was wearing the, quote, naked dress that rumors started flying. So whether or not people knew how long she had been intimate with the Kennedy brothers, the rumor mill was now churning publicly. To further complicate things, an FBI file dated July 13, 1962, stated that Marilyn lunched with Jack at Peter's Malibu house, in which she was described as concisely leftist and discussed the morality of the atomic bomb. Not great conversation to be had with the president during the Cold War. Around the same time, she was with Bobby at Peter's Hollywood house, where he then went to Nevada to observe a test of the nuclear bomb. At this exact time, Fidel Castro, communist leader of Cuba, was appealing to the Soviet Union for aid, and he got what he asked for. Of course, nuclear matters were the dominating international issue of the time, and Bobby and Jack were so loose-lipped around Marilyn that the FBI was worried that she was blabbering U.S. nuclear secrets to her ex-husband's people, who were likely talking to Fidel Castro's people. The general consensus between the brothers was finally, oh God, this is bad. Like, she can make this public, all these things that we've been discussing, you know, nuclear matters, all this time, she has the power to make this public, and she knows people. You know, they realized that perhaps they maybe shouldn't be hanging out with her anymore under these circumstances. So they cut her off. It was a long time coming, but it devastated Marilyn. A month before she passed away, she stayed with longtime friend Arthur James. In an interview, James said that she told him everything about the fallout with the Kennedys. She was basically told to never make contact with them ever again. Bobby reached out to her to give her the news, but Jack never said a word. James thought this was the beginning of the end. Never hearing from JFK again destroyed Marilyn. This only amplified her downward spiral, combining alcohol and sleeping pills daily. Then, on August 5th, 1962, Marilyn was found dead in bed at her house. The phone remained in her hand, and a bottle of sleeping pills sat next to her bed. There was no note, and the coroner said that it was an overdose of drugs, a potential suicide. At only 36 years old, Marilyn's death was the talk of Hollywood for over 2 years, and even today, people still talk about it, of course. You know, there's so many conspiracy theories, so many important players involved, Bobby and JFK, Hoffa, murder, FBI files, nuclear weapons, so many conspiracies swirling because of those things. The public story relied on the accounts of, again, her psychiatrist, Dr. Greenson, and her housekeeper, Mrs. Murray. On Saturday, August 4th, her last day alive, around 8 p.m., Marilyn went into her bedroom and closed the door. Then, perhaps sometime around 3 a.m., Miss Murray, her housekeeper, woke to find Marilyn's light still on in her room. The door was locked, but she got pretty worried about it. It was, like, unlike her, so she phoned Dr. Greenson. Dr. Greenson came to the house and peered through her window to find her lying face down in her bed. He then broke the window and was able to decipher that she was gone. They called the police at 4:25 a.m. So you might be thinking to yourself, okay, the housekeeper noticed the light was on at 3 a.m. They called the police at 4:25 a.m. Like, that feels like kind of a long time. Like, wouldn't you call the police as soon as something seems wrong? I mean, granted, we don't know at what time he saw her, like, on the bed, supposedly. Well, what if I told you there's even more of, like, a blurry line with how long she was face down in the bed before they called? Because Natalie Jacobs, the wife of Marilyn's PR guy, Arthur Jacobs, told investigators a very different story than even this story. Natalie claimed that she and her husband, Arthur, were at the Hollywood Bowl that night attending a concert, and an attendant came to get Arthur shortly after 10 p.m. There was a phone call waiting for him in which he was told that something was very wrong at Marilyn's house. According to his wife, he manipulated the story of what went down that night. The story released to the public with Miss Murray and Dr. Greenson was, according to her, a lie. Corroboration for Natalie's story came from Arthur's staff member, Julie Rowell. His job was PR, of course, so his goal was to always to keep the press at bay, so that's likely why he fabricated the story. So if she died closer to 11 p.m. when he got that phone call, what was going on at Marilyn's house between 11 p.m. and 3 a.m. / 4:25 a.m. when they actually called the police? When the false story came out, the DA was contacted by a former ambulance driver, Ken Hunter. He claimed that he was called to Marilyn's house that night. He drove for Schaefer Ambulance Company. When contacted, Mr. Walt Schaefer himself said that Marilyn was taken to Santa Monica Emergency. They both completely contradicted the police story that she was found dead in her bed at home. He said that she was alive but comatose when she was taken to the hospital. A later account from Dr. Greenson said that she died in the ambulance on the way to St. John's Hospital and her body was then taken back to her house. And apparently he was in the ambulance, so he was there much earlier than 3 a.m., as the original story said. So Reed Wilson and Fred Osta, they were private investigators, said that there's much more that went on that night. Bobby was in L.A. the night that Marilyn died. There are tapes from Marilyn's house the day of her death that show that Bobby called the house after being no contact with her for quite some time because of all the nuclear stuff. And she said, quote, "Don't bother me. Leave me alone. Stay out of my life. I feel passed around. I feel used. I feel like a piece of meat." The private investigators think that this puts her in a really bad state of mind, you know, after receiving this call from someone that she used to consider a friend, a lover, whatnot. She was hot and heavy for Bobby and Jack, we know, and by the end, she felt used, you know? Even if it was just a friendship that, you know, sometimes became sexual, like, she felt like she was used by them and tossed when, you know, she, I don't know, the trust was broken, like, it just felt like a weird thing, and she was upset about it. You know, she was not heartbroken per se, but she felt taken advantage of. And she even called the White House to say to Jack, quote, "Get your brother away from me. I hate all of you." Miss Murray, Marilyn's housekeeper that saw her light on in her room, even earlier that day, noted how affected Marilyn was after she received that call from Bobby. Bobby apparently then, after the call, showed up at her house. And this has been corroborated as well. A local detective found an entry that a helicopter had flown from LA to San Francisco with Bobby on board. He was trying to confirm that he'd been in town and then flew out later that night after she died. So a lot of mysterious things here. And things are about to get a lot messier. Because remember those private investigators that I mentioned, Wilson and Otash? So these guys were actually hired by Peter Lawford. So remember Peter, you know, the House of Peter was where Marilyn and the Kennedys hung out, partied, all of that. Like, he was one of their friends. So Peter Lawford hired these private investigators to go in and clear Marilyn's house of any evidence of the Kennedys. All photos of the Kennedys and Marilyn were seized, except for one from JFK's birthday party, as well as all recordings from the homes of Marilyn and Peter. So, cleanup job. The FBI was also on the scene of her death quickly to keep it hush-hush. It was so unusual that the order had to come from Jack or Bobby to keep her death under wraps and make sure the story that got out about her death is the one that they wanted, the one that didn't involve them at all. So, in the end, was Marilyn murdered? No, probably not. She died by overdose. However, it's very clear that the circumstances of her death were deliberately covered up. Why? Well, yes, because of her connection to the Kennedy brothers, but it just makes you wonder, like, what else was there? In the end, her last decade of life was closely monitored by Hoffa. Remember that guy that, you know, was the arch nemesis of Bobby Kennedy and whatever, like, he was secretly taping them and whatnot. You know, she was monitored by this guy. She was also monitored by the FBI because of her relationship with the communist Arthur Miller. Whether she knew it or not, she lived under a microscope. The sad thing is, like, she didn't even know half of it. Like, she didn't even know that her house was bugged, you know? She knew, though, that things were looking bleak. She knew that the Kennedys wanted nothing to do with her. She knew that, you know, they assumed that they kind of treated her like a piece of meat, and that she just didn't feel like she had many friends. She didn't feel like she had many people to rely on. And once she overdosed, the details of the night of her death were then manipulated by the Kennedys and by the FBI and the private investigators and everybody that was involved, you know, all before word got out about her demise. So they acted like before the public or anyone even knew that she had died, like there was a cleanup job happening, which just feels so insensitive. I mean, I don't even think her family knew, like the ones, like the people that actually cared about her amongst those people, because of course, you know, it's murky even who was there for her in the end, aside from the psychiatrist, but really, like, still murky circumstances with that. You can't help but sympathize with the woman who got in over her head and became the mistress of the two most powerful men in the U.S. in the early 1960s. It's just a really crazy story. And, you know, I thought I knew most of it, and, you know, but the details just astound me, and like all of the different men. And at the end of the day, she was a star. She was a fantastic actress. You see any of these films that she's in and you just fall in love. And she is just this magnetic person, like in those films. It all started with Norma Jean. She had a tough upbringing in foster care, and she did what she had to do, she felt, to achieve her dreams of acting and being taken seriously. She started her own production company and all of these things that she did, but yet her end was still like in the hands of men, right? And like how the PR people spun things and how it was told was all these men wanted to get involved and shape the story of everything. And it just is so upsetting. Like, God, I wish she had more years, you know, more time to get her footing and to establish herself as just her, you know, maybe go back to being Norma Jean. And I don't know, it's just one of those stories that just gets crazier every time I look into it. This isn't the first time I've read about Marilyn's story, but it's definitely the deepest dive that we've done. Sarah, my researcher, did a fantastic job getting all of the facts. And wow, guys, wow, wow. Definitely, as homework, go watch some of Marilyn's iconic films. Rest in peace, Marilyn Monroe. We miss her. But just crazy, like how, yeah, the Kennedys, there's like a whole podcast series that I could do about the Kennedys and the Kennedy curse and, you know, how some members of the Kennedy family were actually great, you know, but this is a testament to just men being the worst. Anyway, that, guys, was another episode of Found Objects Podcast. Hope you guys thought this was interesting. And remember, things aren't always as they appear. Goodbye. This episode was produced, edited, and told by Katie Bellotti. Research by Sarah Schilling. Podcast artwork by Siri Devlin. Follow us on Instagram at Found Objects Podcast. Tune in next Wednesday for a new episode. Goodbye.
Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.